The J-Talk Podcast.
Yosh!
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, a testing few days for all of us that have made us question the meaning of it all.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if I like football anymore after watching Moriyasu's Japan over the last week or so. It's been, a real struggle, but I suppose at least there was a win over China. But there's not many positives to take from this international break.
No, that's absolutely correct. Yeah, for any supporters of Japanese football, the two Samurai Blue games were a very painful watch, and also struggling in recent times, the past couple of weeks especially, is our guest on this episode, Scott McIntyre. His podcast co-host tried to kill him off, but we can, safely assure you all that he has not succumbed to the coronavirus and is back and banging on J-Talk. Scott, great to have you back on. How are you going?
Thanks. I'm getting a lot better. But it did knock me about for quite a while. I still have those sense of smell, which I don't know. The longer it goes, I'm thinking it may not be a bad thing. There's more bad smells in life than good smells, I think.
And yes, you're in the guts of Tokyo, so certainly
right.
When the wind blows in the wrong direction, you're struggling on a daily basis. All right then. Well, we're as you can tell, listeners, we're not in a hurry to discuss Japan's two games over the past week or so. Very painful watching, as Sam mentioned in the intro. It all got going last Friday at the Suita Stadium with a 1-0 defeat at the hands of Oman. And Sam, we can. We don't have to drill down on this game in too minute detail, because this was just a really poor performance from a Japan side that was just lacking any sort of a spark.
No, it was horrible. It was I hated it from the moment I saw the team, to be honest. It was a team picked from 2018. You'd got Shibasaki in there, who's not done anything for a few years. Now Michi Ueda was starting, Genki Haraguchi, and you look at you've got Furuhashi on the bench, Doan, Kubo. Any sort of life in the team was not there on the pitch, and it was a lifeless display, a really typical kind of Moriyasu, no adventure. And they got what they deserved, Japan, in losing that game. I thought Oman were the better team. They had the better chances, and Japan, pretty useless. I think that's the way I can describe them.
So it was echoes of 2016, Scott, when Japan lost their opening game of the final round of qualifiers for the last World Cup. That was 2-1 at Saitama at the hands of the UAE. So obviously at that point in time, I'm not sure how good your memory is, but 5 years ago, we were all panicking because the stat doing the rounds was that no team that had ever lost their first final round qualifier had gone on to make it to the World Cup. Of course, Japan ultimately did so and sealed top spot with a game to spare. But your concerns were aired on the last episode of the Asian Games. So we know you have serious concerns about Moriyasu in charge and some of the personnel that he's plumped for. So I guess the broader picture here is as long as Moriyasu's in charge, and Japan are capable of poor performances like the one last Friday against Oman, and indeed Tuesday night against China was not much better. So you obviously have serious concerns that if Moriyasu's left in charge, that Japan might struggle to make it automatically to this 2022 World Cup.
Yeah, possibly, and like you said, results and performances have to a degree validated those thoughts I had, but these aren't new thoughts, as you know, because I've talked with you guys and elsewhere basically since Moriyasu was appointed, because it was in my opinion, it was the wrong appointment right from the get-go, and nothing has happened to change my thought on that. You look at things on surface, okay, you made it to the last four in the Olympics, but I thought by playing fairly uninspired football and playing with the brakes on, which is a hallmark of Moriyasu, going right back to the Hiroshima days. But what happened with Hiroshima is this style brought relative results. And anyone who's listened to this podcast for ages knows my thoughts on the game more broadly. So that's fine if that's what you want, a results at any cost kind of mentality. which is one, a short-termist approach. I don't think it's an approach that suits the Japanese mentality about the game, and I certainly don't think it plays to the strengths of this particular side either. And what it ultimately does is it caps your ambition. So with Moriyasu at the helm, how far can Japan go? They can qualify, absolutely, no question. They can and should qualify. And I think equally, there's no question that they could make it to let's say, the quarterfinals of the World Cup. With a progressive, aggressive coach, and Ange Postecoglou was in the discussions for this role, my understanding of it, both prior to and during the tenure of Moriyasu. So if, for example, you had someone of that ilk in who said, we can play and we can match it with anyone in the world, then just as Japan can and could have won the Olympics, in my opinion, they can. And let's not forget, under a Koji Nishino, was far more progressive and far more able and willing to take the brakes off. They were very close to progressing very, very deep into the World Cup. And indeed, if they had got through that game, which could have gone ultimately either way at the end, then, in my opinion, there was nothing stopping him from going on and winning. And it should also be the mentality and the case now that Japan should be thinking not just to qualify for Qatar, but they should be thinking, we can win the World Cup. We can get into the personnel selections and areas of weakness and so on. But equally, I wouldn't mind touching on what other nations have been doing, what Vietnam has been doing, what China has been doing, what Qatar has been doing, what Iran, Iraq, all these nations getting either players with roots coming in, or in the case of China going, stuff it, let's just get anyone in who's been here for 5 years, which I think is potentially a way to fix some of the problem areas that Japan has, particularly in defense, but we can get into that later on if you want. But the thing with Moriyasu is you're capping your ambition. So is this what the JFA wants? Because with this guy in charge, you don't, generally speaking, win and progress deep in major tournaments by playing timid, reactive football, and certainly not playing to the strengths that you have. Japan is blessed with an exceptional generation of creative midfield orchestrators who can do things. And you look even at the difference yesterday, playing Kubo centrally, which is the first time that I remember under Moriyasu that he's been played there. And you get him on the ball, and he's the one player, along with Furuhashi, who look like that they can have the individual qualities to break teams open, which under the way that Moriyasu plays is a crucial ingredient. You need those kind of players because you are playing so reactively, unless you meet a team like China, which put 27 players behind the ball, and then you need them even more to be centrally created to try and provide the way through that, which Kubo, as it turned out, couldn't do on his own yesterday. So he's capping himself, by the way, Pixie Sim. He's capping himself tactically. That's fine. That's the way he's been since Hiroshima, and it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. So the JFA went into this process knowing that this was what they're going to get. And I can imagine that that now we've come this far, they're going to blindly stick it out, because you've played on paper the two weakest teams in the group, one of them at home, and the other one at a neutral venue, not their home, where they would have had an event. And you've come away with two uninspiring performances, admittedly against a very negative Chinese team, but not looking good in either game. So there has to be questions raised as to whether they're going to qualify. And then what happens after that? So it just comes back to me, this is as much shining a light on what's going on at the JFA as well, because are they... is this the extent of their ambition? They've laid out all these, 500-year, millennia-long kind of plans. That's all well and good. But this is not the guy that's going to deliver the success that you need. And that should be really evident to any of the technical staff within the JFA. So it comes back on them. I would have yeah, one, I would have never appointed him. I certainly would have got rid of him after the Olympics, and I would have been very tempted to get rid of him after the Oman game. But they've stuck with him all the way through all this, the way he plays, the selections, the... Yeah, some of the stuff with the Olympics, you know, bringing a guy like Mitoma in and then not using him is criminal. And the negative way that they played throughout that whole tournament. But the JFA have sat down, they've obviously done reviews into it and go, okay, we're on the right course. So for me, the bigger question is what's happening with the identity of Japanese football. And that's the concerning element and aspect of it, because whoever is making these decisions within the JFA is obviously satisfied enough with the way that they're playing, and yeah, like I said at the start, it's not, in my opinion, it's not the Japanese mentality. It's not the way that fans want football to be played, and it's not playing to the strengths of the team. So okay, this is what we've got. So what do we do? It doesn't look like the JFA are going to make a move on it. So we're stuck with it, and what it's doing is, I think, setting back Japanese football, which is really disappointing.
Yes, well said, all of that, Scott. And I guess, Sam, well, obviously in the cold light of day, Japan have gone on to beat China in the second game, and, yeah, that might be enough to keep Moriyasu in a job. But, I mean, perhaps, although it would have been obviously a massive shock to the system, perhaps it would have been for the best if Japan had, say, even just drawn against China, and that might have forced the JFA's hand as Japan would have slipped further behind in the group, behind the leaders Australia and Saudi Arabia, who are both two wins from two, and coincidentally are Japan's next two opponents in the group in October. It's a Saudi Arabia away and then Australia at home. So just briefly then on the win over China, 1-0. Apologies to any Omani listeners who are tuning in. You know, obviously you guys deserve massive credit for your performance at Suita, and we don't want to gloss over that. But obviously this is a Japanese football podcast, so we're more focused on that. But as Sam said earlier, a fully deserved win for Oman, and I'm sure Scott shares that sentiment as well. So Moriyasu made four changes to the 11 for the China game. Obviously, Sakai cried off and decided he didn't want to travel, and fair dues after the dross that Japan served up against Oman. I didn't blame him myself. That meant to say Moroya came in, even though Miki Yamane is arguably the more informed player. Tomiyasu was back after his move to Arsenal was completed, and he replaced Wada alongside Yoshida, while it was Akubo and Furuhashi in a more exciting looking attacking lineup. So Sam, I guess that would have pleased you at kickoff, but then, Japan were brighter for spells, but overall, again, another very flat performance against a team that was, as Scott said, very content on parking the bus from very, very early doors.
Yeah, it pleased me just about that there's a little bit of intent at least shown, at least in the lineup. And yeah, Kubo played very well, and he was definitely, I thought, Japan's best player. And in the first half, it wasn't great, but there was a lot more about Japan going forward. They had to come up against a wall with the Chinese had set up there. They weren't really looking to go forward at all. So those games, they're always difficult. And no matter how much possession that Japan had, they struggled to create too much. I felt too often Japan kind of play it about quite slowly, then pass it back to the fullback, who just whips in a cross into Osaka, when the defence is set, there's not a lot Osaka is going to do about it. But eventually Japan kind of grew into it. They had a few chances where maybe Kubo would take something on himself, or there was a little bit of a spark from Junior Ito. He's a bit more direct than necessarily the other players like Kubo and Doan and those in this squad, and he adds a little bit of something different. So they got a goal, but what really frustrated me in the second half was there was no real intent to go on and get that second goal. And when you're against a team which really, as poor as China were, they should have, Japan should be looking to go and beat these teams 3 or 4-0, kind of make a statement, but they didn't. They lost Furuhashi. They just kind of went back into their shell, brought Haraguchi on. It was, again, like the safe approach, which I know is what we're going to get with Moriyasu, but it's just so frustrating to watch. And I echo everything that Scott has said about the hampering the development of the Japanese players, because there are so many good young attacking players that Japan have, both in the squad and outside of it. If you look at Mitoma and Maeda and all those sorts of players, and they're not getting a look in here with this team. And yeah, it's going to be 2 years. I'm sure it'll be leave at the end of the World Cup cycle. Well, it's 2 years of development that they're not going to get, and it's just really frustrating. And I don't think Japan are good enough to be reliant on a defensive approach. Defensively, they're really poor, especially in the fullback areas. Scott mentioned the lack of pace necessarily with Yoshida and Tomiyasu, and when you lose Tomiyasu as well, I mean, Ueda's defending in that first game was so poor, and if he's like the next one up, I mean, it's a really bad look for Japan. And it works if you've got a very organised team that maybe Moriyasu can work on, as he did with Hiroshima, but I don't think this Japan team has the personnel that is matched up to Moriyasu's style. They have all the attacking players in the world. They have to use them, but obviously they're not going to, and I think we're in for a very frustrating couple of months as Japan kind of muddle their way through this qualifying section. And next month is very important, two very difficult games, especially going away to Saudi Arabia. And yeah, I mean, they could be looking into a really difficult situation if results don't go their way.
All right, so let's briefly touch on those two opponents for Japan in October then, Scott, if we could. I can't profess to have seen the full game. It did appear that Saudi Arabia were a little bit fortunate in the first game against Vietnam. Vietnam took the lead very early, then lost a player to a red card early in the second half, and Saudi Arabia scored three goals after that to ultimately run out 3-1 winners. So, I mean, you can let us know whether that was an entirely appropriate result or not, but yeah, to me it seemed like Vietnam a little bit hard done to, but they then went on and beat Japan's conquerors in the opening game, Oman, 1-0 away on Tuesday/Wednesday. That was in Muscat, while Australia defeated China 3-0 in the group stage opener and then headed to Vietnam on Tuesday and returned with a 1-0 victory to keep them a perfect two wins from two. Just interestingly enough, just for some the trivia buffs out there, all three goals in the group on Tuesday/Wednesday were scored in the last 5 minutes of the first half. So that's fascinating, isn't it, listeners? So yeah, Scott, these are incarnations of Saudi Arabia and Australia then. Japan finished above both of them in qualifying for the 2018 World Cup. Both of them have a three-point head start on Japan heading into the October meetings. But obviously, if Japan take care of business, then that script will be flipped. But yeah, how are you feeling about how Saudi Arabia and Australia have gotten on in the first two games? And yeah, what sort of opponents will they be for Japan next month?
So just briefly going back to Oman, if you did want to hear more about Oman, you could tune into the next edition of the Asian Game, because we will have their coach, Branko Ivankovic, joining us. Your summary of the Saudis is right. That this does, of course, give me a chance to mention my boyfriend, who scored the opening goal for Vietnam, the one and only Nguyen Quang Hai. And Vietnam looked good, actually. They were dreadful yesterday against Australia, but for the first period against the Saudis, they were good. And yeah, as you said, the sending off changed things. Saudi Arabia ended up with two penalties and ultimately going through fairly comfortably. And from what I saw of the game with Oman, they certainly looked the better, the Saudis, in that team as well. And yeah, I guess living up to their billing as one of the heavyweights in the group, so it doesn't help when, yeah, they've already got 6 points on the board, and Japan need to go across to Jeddah for the next games. This is the other thing to factor in this international window, is that the first of those matches is away in Saudi Arabia, and then 5 days later, you've got to come back and face Australia. We're still not exactly sure whether the game, their home game in match day 3 against Oman, will be supposed to be in Sydney, but I'm not sure that that will happen. So they may actually end up having less travel than Japan for the second match. So they're all important points to factor in. But yeah, certainly the Saudis, in my opinion, probably overall across the two matches have been the best of the six nations in the group. Australia were decent against China without being particularly impressive, and then got the win without being particularly impressive against Vietnam yesterday as well on an absolutely atrocious service. It's been kind to Cal Paddocks to turn that. Cal Paddocks was an absolutely dreadful pitch that the Vietnamese turned out in Hanoi, and in a sense similar to the way that China played against Japan, where Vietnam sat very deep, invited Australia on, and it took them a fair while to come up with the solutions in terms of being able to break them down. So I mean, the group is very tight, but this Saudi match now is absolutely crucial. Going away against a very well coached and national team of vastly experienced guy at the helm, who've looked fairly good in qualifying so far, we can imagine that what Moriyasu is thinking is maybe go and get a point there and then look to get the three back at home against Australia. And you know, obviously, there's been so many battles down the years between Japan and Australia that could really go either way as well. But it's incredibly delicately poised early on. And yeah, geez, I don't know. If you go to Jeddah and you lose that in a month from now, it's there's obviously then massive pressure to make sure you get the job done against Australia, and it's really all on. So it comes back to selection issues. Can I propose something too? Sam, you might know if this is right. Remember, FIFA recently changed the eligibility, right, for national teams. I believe as part of that, you can now change your nationality within 3 years. Is that correct? Even if you've played senior football for a previous nation, but within 3 years after that, then you can switch to a secondary nation. Is that your understanding of the thing?
The 3 years is definitely correct. I'm not 100% sure if it's senior internationals or like under 21s or that sort of thing, because I know here Aaron Wan-Bissaka can go to, I think it's DR Congo, after, even though he's played for the under 21s, but I'm not 100% sure if it's senior internationals. Maybe friendlies. That might be the caveat, friendly internationals, and you might be able to change. Did Wilfried Zaha do that, play a friendly for England, then play for the Ivory Coast?
I'm actually pretty sure it's 3 years from the last senior appearance. So it's no longer youth stuff. You can change. And I think a lot of that was done, you know, we see situations, I don't know, for example, with refugees in Afghanistan. You know, maybe you've played there, but you've decided you need to start your life somewhere else, and you should therefore be able to do that. So that, to me, opens up a whole lot of curious questions about foreigners in Japan. I mean, for example, someone like Leandro Damia becomes eligible to play for Japan, which is, for me, something I would be looking into. I'm not sure then if, you know, you need to also then meet, I think, whatever the five-year requirement is, but it certainly opens up windows. And even looking at, you know, maybe not for this cycle, but the defensive issues with Japan are so massive at the moment. In my opinion, you look at Maya Yoshida yesterday and the game before against Oman. It was absolutely dreadful. I mean, simple balls that you can't trap. When you're trapping the ball, it's going the wrong direction, 3-4 meters here, and what it's doing is it's setting back the time that you have to then establish the attacks going forward, because you've got to run 15 meters back behind you where you mistrap the ball under zero pressure and restart the thing, and it's taking time. I thought actually Tommy Asu was actually better than I've seen him last night. I actually looked halfway decent, but the point I keep coming back to with these two is they're so immobile, and Maya now is he was never technically the best, but but he's losing whatever technical capabilities he had on the ball. And that's okay against the China, where you're not under any sort of great pressure, but bigger tests are going to come in this group. And when you saw, this was the difference to me, it wasn't so much the difference between Japan in the Oman game and the China game, it was the difference in the opposition. Because Oman, against expectations, came to Japan and said, we're going to come and have a go at them because we know we can get to them, and we know if we pressure the, particularly these guys at the back, and Gonda's not the world's best goalkeeper neither, which is another case I'll be talking very closely with Mr. Jakuba Slovic up at Sendai and saying, hey, let's get to this 5 years. And why not? If Slovic is the best Japanese keeper, hands down, if he's eligible to play. Like it's not even a close competition. He's the number one, two, and three on the list. So the minute that that guy gets to his five-year eligibility or whatever it is under these new regulations, I would be securing him a Japanese passport. It's not going to work in this cycle. But for the next cycle, he's still at a good enough age that he should be Japan's keeper. While we're at it, the defense should be Thiago Martins and Jesse El. If other nations are doing it, because they walk into, in my opinion, Slobik, Jesse El, Thiago Martins walk in as the best three players in their position that Japan has. And if other nations, Japan has a history with this, let's not forget, going back 20, 30 years, right? So why not? If you've got a resource that is eligible, the Qataris have built their team on the back of, 16-year-old kids from Guinea and Senegal, right? And 75% of their team, despite what they'll tell you, are not Qatari in any way, shape or form. They brought them over as kids. They met their eligibility, and now they're hosting the World Cup, right? It's good enough for them. It's good enough for China. It's good enough for all these nations right across Asia and beyond. So why, in my opinion, particularly with the issues you've got up front, okay, Osaka took his goal well last night, but I don't think he's perhaps no longer the answer. And if there's any way to get Leandro Damia eligible for this cycle, which I don't know if there is, that would need to be looked into more carefully. But, I think he would walk into the team. And indeed, I don't know, maybe get Iniesta playing for Japan. It's probably been 3 years since he's played for Japan. So it just opens up so many possibilities. But in the areas where Japan is so weak and with really limited options coming through, which is in goal and the two central defensive positions, I would absolutely be doing everything I can to look at these players. You'd probably throw Sam's mate Eduardo into this mix as well. Eduardo, Thiago Martins, and Jesse El, and they're your three best central defensive options compared to what you've got now. So I just think there needs to be some form of creative thinking done into how to solve some of the issues where they're weak. And then I would love also for Moriyasu to look outside the thing, right? He pulled a little bit of a surprise in picking Nagatomo, who's clubless. Did reasonably well across the two games, but it's been a long time, I think, since a player without a club for a couple of months has turned out in a World Cup qualifier for Japan. But the love I have for this guy Shion Homma down in Niigata in J2, who curiously hasn't been starting regularly over the past month. But you watch every time this guy is on the ball, he's an absolutely dynamic, electric talent, and I think brings more to the team than someone like a Haraguchi does. But will we ever find this guy, Moriyasu, this old conservative Japanese guy who quite curiously pretends, on the sideline with this kombini kind of notebook he has? When yesterday he pulled it out of his pad and he was perusing it upside down. So it's like the famous picture of George Bush reading the book to the kids, a picture book, and it was upside down as well. This Muppet actually had his notebook upside down pretending to look at it yesterday. So this kind of conservative guy is never going to do it, but why not? You've got this dynamic, creative talent who's there, and why not do something? Why do you need to wait for these guys to go to European clubs before somehow then they're validated to be good enough to play for the national team? And yeah, like I said, the other thing that I would be doing very urgently is looking into which of these guys in the J-League, which of the foreigners is eligible and willing to obtain Japanese citizenship, and I'd be getting them into the setup as soon as I can.
On your kind of Slovic proposal there, if Japan don't go down that route, do you think Slovic is part of the problem in that most Japanese, the best goalkeepers in the J-League, they're all foreign goalkeepers? Is there any reason maybe to follow the K-League's decision and have only Japanese goalkeepers in the J-League? Is that a potential solution, or is just, are there problems deeper down in terms of producing Japanese goalkeepers? Because I mean, Kosuke unfortunately didn't pan out for us. But yeah, other than him, I've not really seen any real Japanese goalkeeper that looks capable of being a long-term national goalkeeper.
No, that's actually an idea that I've been throwing around in my head for the last couple of months as well. I don't think that's the issue. I think it's more, whatever's going on in terms of education and development of keepers, particularly with the way that keepers are generally expected to be comfortable with the ball at their feet these days, which the Japanese keepers going back forever have never been, and even this generation are not. I mean, Tani is fairly dreadful, to be honest, with the ball at his feet as a ball playing kind of keeper. He's absolutely not that keeper, and neither is the kid out of Hiroshima or any of the other younger Japanese keepers. So for me, that's more of a problem, is what's going on with the education, where we should be seeing, but this is, it's not exactly a modern phenomenon that the keepers should be playing, has been going on for 10 years, right? So we should be seeing a crop of young Japanese keepers that are technically comfortable with the ball at their feet, and we're not, even with the younger keepers, with even my guy Kosuke was not far from the most technically proficient with the ball at his feet as well. So that's the bigger issue. But you've got Slovic here, so why not use him? And indeed, if the same thing applies, why not try and get Mitch out of retirement once the 3 years have passed for him? But why not, mate? In these issues, in these areas where it's such a concern, which the primary concerns for me are in goal, the two central defenders and the number nine. The rest of it, okay. They've got players coming out of their ears, left, right, and centre. Some, such as Shion Homma, should be getting a look in, but they're not. But that's a separate thing. But the issue is young goalkeepers are not being produced. Ball-playing central defenders, and indeed any form of mobile central defenders, are by and large not being produced, and number nines are not being produced. Why? As you said, because the foreigners are in there occupying those spots in the J-League. Okay, if the Qataris are going to do it, if the Chinese are going to do it, everyone else is going to do it, the Saudis have been doing it, all these nations have been doing it, Japan has done it, why not do it now? Why not? You have options to, as soon as they're eligible, slot in and fill these goals. And with this changing, where you can now, that's a separate debate whether it's right or wrong, but the ability to switch national teams after 3 years, I don't know. Had Mikitani running the thing, we'll have the entire Spain 2010 World Cup winning side turning up to Japan next time around. But it's not a bad idea even for the JFA to consider doing this kind of thing, where you get maybe players in with this specific kind of aim in mind. But that's a longer term thing. But you have guys now that are on the verge of being eligible for this in the J-League. And Matt, I would be running if any of these central defenders or the goalkeepers, and that includes after Koreans, in the league as well. That's probably less likely for the Greens. But any one of those players that I mentioned previously who are able and willing to do it, I would be getting down to immigration post haste to make sure that they are pulling on that Japan shirt as soon as possible.
Well, yes, probably far too forward-thinking for the JFA, but it's definitely some interesting food for thought there, Scott. And, I'm glad that you did get around to mentioning Eduardo, because I'm sure Sam certainly would have at some point. And maybe we should throw a bone to the Extra Time boys as well. Maybe Jordi Boyce fancies pulling on a Japan kit. He's one of the favourites of John Stewart and the gang on Extra Time. So, maybe Jordi.
Not particularly a ball-playing defender, but, he's in the long ball hit and hopes.
Well, he can hoof it, that's for sure, our Jordi.
Yeah,
so
he can,
let's see if he's up for it as well. And
while we're on the Kyoto thing, why not get Peter Itaku?
Oh, well,
he's 38, man. He's still better than you.
Goal machine, absolutely, no question at all. All right, so it's obviously two huge games in October. Then Sam, so as we wrap it up, all we can hope is that Moriyasu maybe goes back to school a little bit after these two games, and hopefully with what we presume is the two better opponents in the group to come, that the Japan will rise to the occasion, maybe even in spite of Moriyasu and his setup.
I mean, we can hope. I don't think Moriyasu is going to change too much there. I'd like to see a little bit more excitement in the squad. I'd like to see Altanaka get a call up. But, I mean, the likes of Mitoma and Maeda, I don't think there's much hope for them. They're not far too flashy to be in this squad. So, yeah, we just got to hope that kind of Japan get through the games. Maybe Moriyasu's style is slightly more set up for an away trip to Saudi Arabia, and they might be able to squeak a 1-0 victory there, and that's probably the absolute best that we can hope for. But yeah, I just hate watching Japan at the moment. The last few games of the Olympics, and these two have just, yeah, I've got no real enthusiasm for them. And previously, I'd absolutely always look forward to these international breaks, but yeah, I'm worried about that Saudi Arabia Japan game. And but yeah, who knows? Maybe he'll learn something, or someone will give him a prod in the right direction. But I wouldn't hold my breath.
All right, so it wasn't great from Japan in this international break, but yes, they at least have 3 points to show for their efforts ahead of those two huge games coming up in October. Okay, we'll take a break, and then when we come back, we'll return to domestic matters. Welcome back, and during the international break, the quarterfinals of the Levain Cup have been played last Wednesday and Sunday. So ever so briefly, we'll run through the results there and what that means for the semi-finals. So Nagoya beat Kashima 2-0 home and away, and will face the defending champions FC Tokyo in the semi-finals after Tokyo overcame a 2-1 deficit from the first leg to win 2-0 on Sunday in their home tie, which was played at Shonan's Lemon Gas Stadium. All the drama, though, was on the other side of the draw, where Cerezo Osaka bounced back from a 1-0 first leg loss at home to city rivals Gumba by stunning the Suita City Stadium crowd in a 4-0 romp on Sunday. Cerezo also reintroduced Takashi Inui off the bench on his return to the club with 25 minutes left in the second leg, on a perfect night for the pink half of Osaka. Cerezo's semi-final opponents will be Urawa, who stunned J1 champions Kawasaki and the Todoroki crowd with an incredible late fight back to triumph on away goals after the tie finished 4-4. After the first leg at Komaba ended 1-1, Frontale came from behind in the second leg and led 3-1 on the night and 4-2 on aggregate after Jao Schmidt's 83rd minute goal, only for Kasper Juncker to pull a goal back 4 minutes later, and after an almighty goal mouth scramble, Tomoaki Makino fired in the decisive goal 4 minutes into second half stoppage time to send Reds through. A remarkable tie ending, as I said, 4-4. So the semi-finals will be played over two legs next month, with Grampus and Reds at home in the first legs, and the final is set for Saitama Stadium on October 30th. All right, so Sam, as I come up for air after all that, what were your major takeaways from those four ties?
Kawasaki really need to get their injury crisis under control, because that defensive line that they put out against Urawa was absolutely ridiculous. I think Tachibanada, central midfielder at right back, Yamamura, another central midfielder at centre back, along with Nobori Zato, who must be the shortest centre back to have ever played a game, and he was there, and then youngster Tanabe, so they were completely all over the place. It was as frenetic as that 3-3 sounds. Otherwise, I thought Nagoya were incredibly comfortable for a large part of their tie against Kashima, which is not something you always expect. So Kashima, again, that team that is great 1 week, it's dreadful the next. And then, yeah, Tokyo got through pretty well. I mean, Sapporo just wasted so many chances. We'll come on to their game tonight against Cerezo, but they just can't finish, and it's so easy to score against them. So that's another frustrating one for Sapporo, who would like to have matched their final appearance from a couple of years ago. And then, yes, Cerezo just destroyed Gamba in that second leg. Gamba were absolutely dreadful. Had no answer when Cerezo went 1-0 up. And Cerezo, yeah, just kind of, it was pretty embarrassing. And I don't know if you saw the video clip of some of the Gamba supporters after the game, held back by the flimsiest piece of fencing you'll ever see, and they're pretending to be really angry, I think, at this 4-0 defeat. It was slightly embarrassing, but not quite as embarrassing as Gamba's performance. So, but yeah, we've got an interesting set of ties for the semi-final, and yeah, it could be a a welcome distraction from whatever Japan are going to do in their international games.
That's very well said. Yes, indeed. So, yeah, once again, it's Nagoya versus FC Tokyo on the left-hand side of the draw, and Urawa versus Cerezo Osaka on the right-hand side. All right, so we'll move on and, yeah, talk about the two J1 games that we have to catch up on. They were postponed for various reasons earlier on in the season. And what this means is that after, Sapporo have hosted Cerezo Osaka tonight, that all clubs have now played 27 games. So each team has 11 to go in the season. So last Sunday, in a game postponed from mid-August, from match day 24, Hiroshima drew 1-1 at home against Kobe. The home side had Reina shown a second yellow card 13 minutes into the second half, but they took the lead 8 minutes later through Shunki Higashi, but Vissel equalised 6 minutes later through Daiju Sasaki. That result moved Kobe back up to third, a point ahead of Kashima, Tosu and Nagoya, and three clear of Reds. But obviously, yeah, playing for over half an hour against 10 men, they obviously they would have expected to have won that game and moved 3 points clear, but yeah, that's inconsistent Kobe for you. And then tonight, yes, as we mentioned, one of the benefits of recording later on in the week is that we did get to see this game tonight at Atsubetsu. Sapporo hosted Cerezo Osaka but lost 3-0. Obviously, Cerezo carrying on the good vibes after thrashing Gamba on Sunday. The third goal was scored by Yoshito Okubo, his 191st J1 goal, and that's result saw Cerezo and Sapporo switch spots in the table. Cerezo now up to 11th and Consadole 12th, both comfortably in mid-table mediocrity. And I guess before we move on to discussing the run-in at J1, for J1 at both the top and the bottom of the table, Sam, well, I guess, yeah, we can wrap up these two games, but also there was some other slightly more meatier subjects that you wanted to touch on.
Yeah, obviously we've spoken before about Kim Myung-hui at Sagan Tosu, and he previously got a suspension for his alleged power harassment, and there have been further reports this week alleging extra things that he may have done. I believe it's under another, maybe a J-League investigation now, and I don't want to necessarily go and speculate about things happening there, but I just wanted to ask Scott, obviously we've seen Choi Kwi-jae and now this with Kim, and we've seen it at Tokyo Verde as well, the power harassment and that issue kind of creeping its head up at J-League clubs. I was just wondering how prevalent, especially for someone not living in Japan, how prevalent an issue is power harassment within the J-League, and why do you think these sorts of things are cropping up more regularly in recent years?
Well, it's a curious term to start with. Power harassment sounds like something that Donald Trump did for 4 or 5 years. Japan has a large and rather bewildering array of harassment claims, as I've learned about over the past couple of years as well. But this is not it's not an issue that's isolated to football. It's an issue. Harassment is always power harassment, right? Because it's come someone in the position of power, so it's a no need for the power in it, and that happens in loads of Japanese workplaces, in all aspects of Japanese society, and it has for a long time, and is ongoing in football. Certainly not isolated to these three clubs. And I think it's more now a case of, as we've seen with various other movements across the world, people perhaps feeling that enough is enough, and standing up for the mistreatment that they've received, which is an excellent and admirable thing, but certainly not easy to do within the confines of Japanese society either. But I think that we'll see more and more of this kind of stuff. And I'll just briefly tell you, I used to know a foreign guy who was doing an internship at one of the top Japanese high school football teams, like an elite top level Japanese high school team that's produced a lot of international footballers, and I think he was supposed to be there for 2 years, but he quit after a year because he couldn't stand anymore what was going on. And that was an old Japanese coach who had been there for a long time and had a real grip over the way that things will run. So his form of discipline was if someone made just a simple mistake in training or a game, they would face physical punishment. But he said the one that the moment that made him say this is enough and I've got to get out of here was there was one incident within a game. Like, it was just a simple nothing, a misplaced pass or whatever. And the coaches pulled the player over at the end of the game in front of the team and said, okay, take your boots off. He's come over, he's picked up the boot, and he's lashed the guy across his face with his own boots. And then these kind of things were regular occurrences. And particularly in other high school sports, and not just sports, but high school, this has been a real big issue in Japan for a long the period of time, the people dying from from harassment, from physical education teachers, and all this kind of thing. So it's prevalent. The way that women are treated, for example, in Japanese workplaces is absolutely outrageous. Has been for a long time and continues to be now. So it's an issue of harassment, coercion, and bullying by people in senior roles of the Japanese society everywhere. And, I've travelled far and wide, but I've, not really seen a society that paints themselves to the outside world as an open and welcoming democracy have, these kind of demons hidden so staunchly and deeply within the grains of society. And absolutely, that's an issue that has and continues to impact football. So I just hope that, that more players, kind of jump on the back of this and take the power back, as we've seen in, maybe different sports in the US and whatnot, where, if the players aren't happy with something, now they're going to stand up and demand changes, whereas before the coach was the kind of overarching power figure. So, what the players have done in really bravely taking on these issues in these three clubs should be applauded. And I hope it continues at every club where this is an issue. It's rooted out of the game, and more broadly than that, heaven knows how it's going to happen, but get rooted out of Japanese society more broadly. Because it's, Sam, football is, as we always say, it's just a reflection of society. The way the game's played, the way it's supported, all these things, football mirrors society. And these kind of harassment issues have been plaguing Japanese society for since the end of World War II, certainly. And I hope it's rooted out at all levels of Japanese society, including, of course, football.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's not something, like as I said before, it's not something necessarily that J-League viewers from outside of Japan would be too familiar with. So thank you, for kind of bringing that to everyone's attention. It's very, very interesting. And hopefully if this J-League investigation does go ahead, then they can show some kind of strong leadership. And yeah, it's not football, necessarily just football's problem, but it's a real opportunity, I think, for the J-League to kind of lead the way in trying to, kind of overcome this.
That's assuming, of course, that the J-League doesn't have similar problems inside their own house.
Yeah.
On which I shall say no more.
Right. Well, all we can hope is that more people come forward with maybe as you say draw courage from overseas examples that these things that have gone on for far too long have to stop, and the first steps have been taken at a number of clubs to eradicate these forms of harassment. So all we can do is hope that leads to a change that trickles down throughout the levels of football, and football can be an agent for change, then that would be a wonderful thing, no question. All right, so the two results from J1, then we can move on past them, and as we said earlier, that leaves us with all clubs having 11 games to go in the season. And when we paused for the international break, Scott, obviously Kawasaki had just re-established a 4-point lead at the top of J1 over Yokohama F Marinos, but on recent results that is looking a rather tenuous buffer, isn't it? Obviously, the final day showdown at the Nissan Stadium looms, on the first day, Saturday in December. But yeah, by that point of the season, obviously the final day, the way things have been going in the past couple of months, I wonder whether it will be a live match for the title, because Yokohama F. Marinos were imperious for 12, 13 games there. Well, we obviously saw Kawasaki having quite a wobble, which was very understandable, of course, with key injuries and obviously the departures of Ao Tanaka and Kaoru Mitoma. So I guess a broad question on the top two, as we certainly know the title race is a race in two, is that if you think, Scott, that Kawasaki can rediscover their mojo and get performances out of formerly fringe players. I mean, Sam mentioned the back line that they had to piece together for the Levain Cup second leg against Urawa on the weekend. And obviously on the flip side for F. Marinos, now under the command of Kevin Muscat, of course, if they can put their 2-0 defeat to Kashima in their last league game behind them and go back on a similar run to close the season that saw them sweep to the title in 2019.
On the bigger picture question there, I think the title is Yokohama's to lose at the moment. The departures that you guys have talked about, we've talked about before, in Tanaka and Mitoma have been huge. And as we talked about right back at the start of the season, what was likely to trip Frontale up was a two pronged kind of issue. One was the fixture overload. So in a way, it's not the world's worst thing that they're out of this ridiculous biscuit cup at the moment, and it's one less thing to worry about. But it's still an absolute issue because the Champions League is back next week, and of course there's a lot in the Empress Cup as well, right? So they've still got all these tournaments crushed. So many matches are going to be played in a short period of time. And the other thing that could have tripped them up was injuries, particularly defensively, which is exactly what we've seen. They're still not having problem scoring goals, and when you've got the likes of Ian Agger and Japan's future number nine Leandro Damião in the team, that's not going to be an issue. The issue is that the depth in midfield is a concern. I think now that you've lost these players, you've got Oshima, still out again, and you've got a converted centre forward who was then converted into a left back who's now been converted into a central midfielder in Hatate, who is decent but not particularly in my opinion proficient in any of those three roles, now filling in as one of these central options alongside Wakizaka, who I don't think is perhaps not taking the steps developmentally that he would have looked to. And then the options out wide, guys like Tomo and Miyagi, who are maybe promising players, but they're not the kind of, in a way, I mean, Tomo was a finished article, right? Because he'd gone through university, came in as an older player. These guys didn't particularly look great in loan spells in the lower reaches of the Japanese football pyramid last year, and I certainly don't think they're quality starting options for a title contender at the moment. That's an issue. But the bigger issue, as Sam touched on, the biscuit cup of the weekend, is defensively. So Japan's future number four, Jessiel, being injured alongside his regular defensive partner in Taniguchi opened up. I mean, there is no depth, absolutely nothing. You've got a defensive midfielder playing right back. You've got a young kid playing his first game there, and a couple of left backs playing, and Yamamura is basically a number six or a number eight. He's playing. So an absolute schmozzle defensively. And I think that's going to be the area that really is going to hurt them, because These players are breaking down. I don't know why, right? But certainly it's no surprise that injuries are coming because of the schedule they've already had, like brutally blazing their way through the summer. And you've now got it again with travel to factor in. Potential quarantine issues, all these kind of things thrown into it as well. And to me, surprisingly, they didn't really do much of anything to reinforce the squad. They would have got money, good money from this transfer. So they brought in this the Brazilian forward who's on the bench at the weekend. I don't think got off. Maybe he's an option, but he's going to hit the ground running. But you look, for example, at what Reds did, right? Bringing in a guy like Hirato from J2, who was a good, solid and player, and he's basically clicked in and immediately become a starting player for them and has done fairly well. So, you know, other kind of contenders made moves as well. Marinos did too. So, it was a bit surprising why they didn't do more to strengthen the squad, particularly defensively. Yeah, and it remains an A-grade mystery to me why on earth I'll keep talking about him until everyone that listens to the pod knows about him. Shion Honma is still mucking around the Denka Big Swan Stadium in Niigata, because he would be the best player in J1 tomorrow. So, what on earth is going on? Whether Niigata refused to release him as they did last year, I know for a fact. But, this year with promotion probably slipping away from them, you would have thought maybe someone could have prized him away and dropped him in as an immediate impact. He would be unbelievable in this frontale setup. But, that's all for another day. If he's not in Europe and he's not in J, if he's floating around J2 then next year, then, it's a... it's a crime against football scouting. Looking at the way that Marinos have continued things, I think largely there hasn't really been much tactical change the way they play. Perhaps a little bit of the handbrake being put on, a little bit more under Muscat. But I think the important thing to recognise was the transition. Although they had... this Japanese coach at the helm for whatever it was, the six or seven matches before Muscat got in. My understanding of that he was purely just a figurehead, put there to do the DAZN kind of press conferences and whatnot. And it was the Australian coaches behind the scenes that Ange brought in that were doing all the work on the pitch and all the work rather than the design interviews. So you had a natural kind of linear progression from Ange and the guys that he trusted within that setup to tactically continue things and hold it over until Muscat got in. Then Muscat has got in and basically just kept the ship nice and steady on course. A little blimp against the Kashima side that can be very, very good on their day, as they were in that game. But factoring in, Marinos, Marinos are out of every competition, right? They're out of the Empress Cup, they're out of the Levain, and they're obviously not in Asia as well. So they're purely focused on the league. Although the gap is there, I still maintain it's their title to lose.
All right, well, that's really interesting, Scott. So we haven't had you on the podcast, obviously, since Kevin Muscat arrived at the Nissan Stadium in the hot seat, in the dugout. So what was your reaction to the appointment then? A well-respected coach in Australia. I'm not sure if you remember, but you introduced me to him back in, was it 2015 or 2016, when the F. Marinos were in the Asian Champions League against Melbourne Victory. We had a nice chat at the team hotel in Yokohama before you snuck me in to watch training at the Nissan Stadium. So obviously, Kevin Muscat, a terrific bloke. His reputation on the pitch wasn't always the best, but as an appointment for F. Marinos and carrying on all of the good work that Ange Postecoglou had done in the previous three and a half seasons. What was your reaction, as I said, to the appointment, and how do you think he can take F. Marinos forward?
My reaction to the appointment. I actually broke the story, so I knew about the appointment for quite a while before it was actually announced. And it was an Ange appointment. There was my understanding that there was something of an internal tussle between the two factions that occupy things at Marinos, between Nissan and CFG. Ultimately, Ange won that tussle and got the guy that he wanted in, because this was an important thing in Ange taking that Celtic job, is that, as he's done in past stints as well, indeed, where Muscat has followed him in previous roles in Australia, that he doesn't want the thing that he's built up for all these years to be either torn down or kind of destroyed in fairly quick order. And I think that was very important to him. So he wanted to say in who came in, and that's my understanding of how obviously that came about. But yeah, as he said, I've known Kevin for quite a while, and I know that he's long had an ambition, in fact, a very strong ambition, to want to coach in Japan. You know, a lot of experience doing so during his time with the Victory down in Australia. So this is a move that he's been wanting for a long time, yeah, and you couldn't have a better situation. The issue is he's been out of coaching for a little bit of time. He had that brief stint over in Belgium, and obviously, again, a big connection with that club and Japanese football as well. But, you know, we didn't really get to see how things were going to unfold or how he was going to mould the team, because it didn't last, you know, more than a third of the season over there. So, yeah, of course, they're not the same kind of coach, but neither, I think, are they as ideologically opposed as maybe it's been pointed out. Perhaps, yeah, not as gung-ho, but there's not many coaches in the world, as we know, are as gung-ho as Andrews. By the way, I've not watched much of Scottish football, but now DAZN very kindly had that Old Firm match on last week. My Lord, how bad are that Rangers team? I know they won the game, but geez, it was it was like watching football from the 1960s. It was absolutely dreadful. So, I only increased my belief that once Ange gets things together there, that there's probably going to be no one touching them. So the issue now for Muscat is he's come in halfway through the season and in an unbelievable position where you've got a very strong squad. You're in an excellent position in the league, and all you need to do is just keep it humming over. And crucially, you've got the guys there, the assistants, that tided it over during the transition period and had been there, one of them from this year and one of them back a year before that. So, you know, knew the ins and outs of the club, knew the ways around the dressing room, the power issues here, there and everywhere, and you can immediately hit the ground running in an absolutely ideal situation, and importantly, not just in a footballing sense, but all that stuff behind the scenes that a lot of people don't see or understand how kind of important it is to be able to slip into that kind of scene. Whereas, you know, most players that are coming, or sorry, coaches that are coming in mid-season will come in with two or three of their own guys. All the old guys will be swept aside. I remember my mate Gary White, when he took over at Tokyo Verde, he actually had to sleep in the same bed as Latina. And that's not that he was in the same apartment and therefore the same bed that Latina is in. And you know, Latina is going to be a key part in my novel, the Corona lockdown novel. And nobody wants to sleep in the same bed as Mr. Latina, I wouldn't think, except for Mrs. Latina, maybe. So crucially, he had all that stuff behind the scenes to be able to plug in and access with people that you know and trust, because that's really not often the case, especially not the case with foreigners coming into Japanese setups where there's disgruntled coaches who thought they should have had it, who were running around with knives and all this kind of stuff. So just as importantly as the footballing situation, I think it's the culture of the club situation that he stepped into a very, not ideal, but a good environment with all that knowledge that you can trust to tap into, and then just let the thing roll basically as it has been until the end of the year, and then you can start from next year to transform it as you want.
You said that basically he's carried on as before, but the last game I had a few issues with the way that they set up their team against Kashima, bringing in Jun Amano into midfield. I felt it kind of really, there was a lot less solidity in that midfield, and they kind of got overrun by Pituka, especially in that game, and dropping El Bear was also a little bit of a surprise. I mean, he'd not been too exerted in the previous midweek game, and they went on to lose that. Do you have any concerns that maybe when the going gets tough a little bit, then he might revert back to a slightly maybe a more negative way of playing, or maybe make a couple of mistakes that wouldn't have been made under Postecoglou? And then also, the issue I have at the moment is Hatanaka out for the season at the back, and Iwata has kind of played here, there and everywhere this season. But what do you make of him as a centre-back in a back four? Do you think he is comfortable enough in that role? And especially, well, I mean, Thiago Martins has also had his injury problems. Do they have a lack of depth at centre-backs, in not quite to the levels of Kawasaki, but still fairly concerning if you have to play any length of time with Iwata and Saneto as the back two?
Well, with Saneto, yes. And, of course, they sold Makito Ito, right, to Ghibli. Was that a loan or was that a full transfer?
Loan, I think.
Yeah, or if it's a loan, maybe you can come back. I thought it may have been a full transfer. But so, yes, depth is an issue with Hatanaka out. But, okay, as long as they can get Japan's future number three, Thiago Martins, back as soon as possible. I think the situation with Iwata is actually good because the problem... It was a kind of a curious signing, right? You know, he played on the left of this back three at his previous club, and then came in without a defined role. And I think it took Ange a couple of months, and maybe ultimately he didn't even figure out what was he. Is he a left sided guy? He's played right back a lot as well. He's played as a six. He's played as a central defender in a two. He's played in a three. All these kind of things, and he was shuffled around and often, in a way, plugging gaps, whether through injury or rotation. So, in a way, I think what's happened is it's good for Iwata, but it's also good for Marinos because he was playing well and pushing for regular starts, but he's not going to break into the back two if you play a four with Hatanaka and Japan's future number three, Thiago Martins, occupying those roles. So then where do you play him? Played him as a six. Okay, if you play him as a six... And you're playing the three central midfielders. You've got Marcos as the eight. That means one of Ogihara or Kida are missing out. So I think it actually better balances the team. You give him a settled role to focus on and concentrate through to the end of the season. I think he's a fine defender. And he's obviously quite good with the ball at his feet as well. So he's a perfect kind of defender for the Marinos way of playing. Football, but then it allows you to really settle down the central midfield as well. Okay, you play maybe the two sixes with Kida and Ogihara and then Marcos in front of him as the eight, and away you go without issues there. I heard you actually talking about Amano on the previous show. I really like Amano. He's an excellent
player. I like him as a footballer. I think he's a terrific footballer. I just didn't think he was right for that game.
Yes, as a six, yes, but as that whatever it is, the 8/10, that Marinos use. I think he's an excellent player in that role for him. But with Iwata shuffling back to the back, you've got your two sixes and your eight. You're sorted. He goes back to being an impact player off the bench. I think the issue with Albert last time, it wasn't. I don't think he was dropped. I just think it was the third match in a week at the end of a very hot Japanese summer. Where you know, I know the sports science thing is. I'm obviously treated very. Very, very seriously under all the top Australian coaches, and you know, if it's a load management issue, players will be rotated, yeah, regardless of almost circumstance or who they are. So I think it was more a case of that. You just got an embarrassment of riches really going forward. Yeah, Maida, Albert, the artist formerly known as Leonardo in his brief stint in J3 a couple of years ago, who now looks like a very good finisher. Up in J1 level in Leo Ciara and you know, options in around the real Miyaichi as well to come into this mix when he gets through things. If you can get Nakagawa playing back to that form he was a couple of years ago, they've just got, yeah, okay, outside of central defence, they've got, yeah, just so many options, I think, in other areas of the pitch, and you've got a machine that's just humming along pretty nicely.
Now, Scott, we mentioned it was the first time we've had you on since Kevin Muscat's appointment. Also, the first time you've been on since you became a megastar in the Scottish football media with the Ange Postecoglou being appointed at Celtic. So there might be some listeners wondering, and I certainly am myself, which is why I'm going to ask you this question. Do you believe or do you know there was a gentleman's agreement, a part of Ange being allowed to leave F. Marinos to join Celtic, that he would not sign any players from Yokohama F. Marinos in this window, because obviously he'd certainly had his favourites in the past three and a half seasons. So I think we did speculate that there might be a couple of players that he would like to take with him. But was that a condition of his release, that he was not able to poach any players from F. Marinos? And also, if I could, two questions in one. Was Furuhashi his first target from the J League once he was appointed? And yeah, presuming he wasn't allowed to sign a player from F. Marinos, that Furuhashi was the one that he wanted.
For the first one, I've certainly heard nothing about any sort of clauses or these kind of things, and I'm reasonably sure that that's not the way Ange operates. Secondly, on Furuhashi, the answer, again, my understanding is yes, that was the primary number one target. I don't know who of this, although, you know, yeah, he's built the team, but he's built it specifically for this context in Japan and to win the J-League, which is, as we know, as I watched, if that team in blue were supposedly the best team in Scotland, then heaven help what the rest of the league's like, because they were absolutely dire. But obviously, yeah, your context over there is you're building a team in a completely different way. So I actually don't know how many of these Marinos players would suit or would fit the specific needs. And like I said, I don't know much to anything about Scottish football outside of watching the dreadful performance of the blue team the other night. But I don't know how many players would fit into that. But certainly Furuhashi does, as we know. Certainly Sean Honma would, down from J2. And certainly my boyfriend Nguyen Quang Hai from Vietnam would as well. Maybe watch this space. But yeah, I don't know how many of the Marinos guys, and pretty much everywhere he's moved in the past, he's tended not to bring players with him from those clubs. So yeah, but I don't think there was any form of agreement. I just think if you've got an option to bring in one Japanese player, then you're going to bring in the best player in the league, which is what he did. And I think, are we also right in saying that Furuhashi is currently the top scorer in both Scotland and Japan?
That is statistically correct. Yes. Yes, indeed.
There you go.
Remarkable.
That wouldn't be many occurrences of that.
So. No, already a Celtic legend, and no question about that. And yeah, Celtic supporters as a whole, as a collective, obviously had their hearts in their mouths once they found out that he'd gone off injured in the game against China. So we hope from the green and white half of Glasgow's perspective that Furuhashi is back to fitness fairly sharpish. The other team that Scott has referenced several times in the past few minutes are obviously hoping that Furuhashi might be set for a spell on the sidelines. So, Sam, as Scott mentioned a few minutes ago, that he believes it's an advantage F. Marinos in the title race, despite the buffer of 4 points that Kawasaki have over them at the moment. And, you know, obviously our opinions will change on this podcast on a week-to-week basis related to the results that these two teams get in the weeks to come. But when you break down the fixture list for both in the remaining 11 match days, and of course, keeping in mind that Frontale do have a huge ACL round of 16 game to come, and they certainly hope they have some extra ACL fixtures to play as well after that. It does appear to me that, if you break it down by the schedules, that, by the time the final match day comes around, F. Marinos might have the advantage in terms of position in the table, and not just in terms of momentum, because Frontale have their rougher stretch remaining to come, basically from the end of September through to the first fixture in November, where F. Marinos have a testing end to the season that obviously culminates in that final day game against Kawasaki. So, for Frontale, again, not going through it game by game, but they do have to play fellow top half teams Kashima, Kobe, FC Tokyo and Urawa, and then finish with Tosu the first game in November. So that is that run of games that I was referencing. Whereas F. Marinos have Hiroshima and Nagoya in their next two, but then their final four are FC Tokyo, Urawa, Kobe, and then, of course, Kawasaki on the final day. So if Frontale slip up in that testing run that basically stretches throughout October, then F. Marinos will have to take advantage. And as I say, they might be on top of the table by the time the final day of the season comes around.
Yeah, they could well be. I mean, it's still speculation. You think Marinos maybe have a couple of easier games in there, but they're both derby games. You play Shonan, you play Yokohama FC. Both, they've got something to play for. I know Scott's a big fan of Yokohama FC and is probably delighted by the transfer business they were doing as they look to overhaul Shonan at the end of the season. But at least they're still playing teams that have got something to play for. They're going to be out to win the games. You look at Kawasaki's two before that game against Yokohama. They've got Gamba and Cerezo Osaka, both teams that are not going to have anything to play for. They'll be stuck in mid-table mediocrity. So you can look at these fixtures in a number of ways. I think maybe the most crucial fixture in terms of this running is this Ulsan versus Kawasaki game. And if I'm a betting man, I think at the moment with Kawasaki's form, they're probably going to go out to Ulsan, which will help them immensely in this running in the league. If they can get rid of that, then they've got an Emperor's Cup game to play, but they could, if they wanted to, they could feasibly just play a rotated team if they wanted to really focus on the league. So, yeah, I don't think this. I'd agree that Yokohama, I'd say at the moment, are favourites. They've definitely got the momentum and the form with them. They haven't got this injury crisis that Frontale do, but there are still a lot of good players in this Frontale team that are good enough to beat most teams in this league. So I still have this coming down, in my opinion, to that final game. I think you could be right that Marinos might just have nicked ahead at that point, but I don't see enough differences in the fixture list to have Marinos any more than three clear by that final game. At least maybe that's just wishful thinking and hoping for an absolute barn burner on the final day. But yeah, I think this game is crucial. It's Ulsan one. If Kawasaki go through, then I think they're in real trouble in terms of the league. But yeah, I think they'll go out, and I think we'll have a really close running for the rest of this season.
Well, yeah, I mean, I could certainly look very idiotic there, considering what Kawasaki have done in the past season and, well, two-thirds of this season. To be doubting them now after a blip that, obviously all the other clubs in the league have had numerous times in the past couple of seasons. It could end up looking very, very foolish indeed. But, it does appear, although obviously in the final games before the international break, the momentum appeared to switch ever so slightly, but we'll see, as we said, if F. Marinos can pick up where they left off before their defeat to Kashima, and if they pick up in the same sort of vein, then, we most definitely will have a very, very fruity title race all the way to the end of the season. I did have ACL Hunt in my notes, guys, but, I mean, yeah, you can throw a blanket over five teams. As we said earlier, Kobe are a point ahead of Kashima, Tosu and Nagoya, and three clear of Reds. But, I mean, with 11 games to go, it's absolutely anyone's that third ACL spot. Perhaps more interestingly, the relegation dogfight has, whether it's perked up a little bit with the Yokohama FC hauling themselves off the foot of the table or not, I guess we can talk about that. But it does appear to me that, the bottom three as it stands are in extremely grave danger. Oita have 17 points, Yokohama FC 18 and Sendai 19. Then Tokushima have a 23 in 17th and the fourth relegation spot. Shimizu and Shonan are both 3 points better off than Vortis. And then you go up the table to Kashiwa and Gamba Osaka, who have 30 points, so 7 points clear of the drop zone, and with enough of a goal difference buffer to consider them safe. So basically, guys, it's a 4 from 6. Do either of you give any of the current bottom three a chance of survival? Scott, I'll come to you first. Oita, Yokohama FC and Sendai, is it curtains for all three of them?
I think it is for Oita, yes. I suspect it is for Sendai, despite the heroics of Japan's future number one. In a sense, I hope it's not at the expense of Shonan, but I kind of hope that Yokohama stay up, because they've been the one that have shown real ambition in a similar way to what Sagamihara have done down in J2, found themselves at the foot of the table. And when, we need to do something radical to shake it up. So Yokohama went with the approach of getting in five Brazilians. Sagamihara went with the approach of getting in five 19-year-olds. And Sagamihara looked a vastly different team in that approach down in J2. And I think Yokohama FC have looked, certainly markedly improved as well. This is Sven Brodersen. You should try and get him on the show. He looks like a real... we know he came in with his kind of nerdy afflictions towards Japanese culture. He looks like one of these kind of guys. But he's been an unbelievable keeper, really. He made some unbelievable saves. And he's what? He's only 21 or 22.
Mm.
Yeah.
So stuff Slavic off being Japan's number one, make him Japan's number one. We could be a number one to 15 years. But he looks like a fine player. I agree with Sam's previous assessments on the defender. Gabriel looks good, and in flashes we've seen the two attacking kind of players they brought in look good as well. So I really appreciate and respect clubs that at that crucial juncture have gone, what are we going to keep doing the same thing that we've already, been doing, and it's not working, or are we going to try something different? And so from that perspective, because I think it's the right approach, I kind of hope that Yokohama drag themselves out of it. And they've certainly set themselves up well, defensively and creatively. And you've now got Yusuke Matsuo back as well. He looks as good as he ever did. So I think there's hope for them. I don't necessarily think that... did you say that you don't think Gamba and Kashua are in trouble?
I think it's 7 points clear. The teams in the... Yeah, Tokushima, Shimizu and Shonan have to worry about themselves rather than trying to catch those two above them, I think.
Yeah, maybe. Geez, I don't know. I've not been particularly impressed with Gamba at all of late as well. And letting another... have a discussion for you guys, but letting someone like Shuhei Kawasaki go, who's outside of Homma, Japan's best like player under 20, like hands down, the best player, and you let him go to bloody Portimonense, it's just absurd. Like, what on earth is going on with these kind of excellent players going to middling clubs with Japanese connections doing nothing, and then coming back as a returning savior 6 years later? It's absolutely ridiculous, and I'm angry at it because I know he was being chased by other progressive Japanese clubs that would have put him into a central role, used him, and then he moves to a big European club. But now it's just ridiculous. Why on earth these gems are being abused by these clubs? I hope Yokohama can stop, but I think Gamba can get sucked down into it as well. If only one. Whatever it is, one of their last six or seven, and not look particularly good, and still are recovering from this ginormous fixture crush that they've been on as well. I'm assuming they're going to lose the Korean guys coming back with quarantine as well. So, I think Gamba are still in some form of trouble as well. You would hope Shimizu with the reinforcements that they've done, although none of them particularly caught the eye, to be honest. Would maybe have enough to stay up, but I think for me the only ones that are definitely down are Sendai and Oita, and it's a bit of a shame with Oita, but good riddance to another one of the old conservative Japanese coaches who shouldn't be in the league anymore. And Tegura Mori, he can go and show his wrist speeds down in J2 for a year or two before going back to the JFA's technical department and leaving those in charge of Sendai to pick up the mess around him. So I think they're gone down, and I think it's a real a mix amongst all the others, with I think the possibility of Gamba still getting drawn down into it.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. I'd say Oita and Vigalta, they don't have enough goals in them. I think we're only 11 games away from Shun Nagasawa finally leaving J1. If he gets another gig, I may offer my resignation for next season.
he's Jubilo Iwata's number 9 when Lugia moves on next year.
Yes, I do, and I don't want to think about that. Just one in gone. But anyway, Yokohama, I think it's maybe too little too late. And the thing, I think it's like the first two games back are crucial because, Brodersen and Gabriel came in, but you haven't seen enough so far of Felipe Vizeu and Salo Mineiro, but they've had this international break to get up to levels of fitness. They need those two to start playing and combining with Yusuke Matsuo. If they can do, they've given themselves a chance, and I agree with Scott. I really appreciate the way that they've gone about it. They've actually tried to do something. Oita, I don't think, did anything in the window. Yeah, well, Hiroto Goya, I think, but that's not going to save them. And otherwise, I just Tokushima, I think there's enough players in that team to get out of it, but I've been in a battle with Danny Poyatos all season. I don't think he's managed to get the best out of them very often. So I still think the bottom four, as it stands, are going to be the ones that go down. Gamba in any other season, if Tokushima were a little bit better, they could be in a little bit of danger, because they've looked terrible for the last few weeks after a mini resurgence that got them into mid-table. But yeah, I'd say at the bottom, I'd obviously like Shonan to go down for no reason other than pre-season podcast. I don't have anything against Shonan, so sorry about that. But yeah, I'm with that bottom four, and definitely Oita Vigalta, probably Yokohama, and I fear for Tokushima. I think they had such promise at the start of the season, but I think they're going to go down.
Yeah, it certainly does look like the incumbents in the drop zone will find it very, very tough going in the last 11 games of the season. Of course, you both failed to neglect the key secret behind Yokohama FC's turnaround since the Olympic break.
The king's been
on the bench.
As a translator, do you see all these stories because you can communicate with someone in Portuguese or whatnot and run?
Oh yes, the king is back. The king is dead. Long live the king, etc., etc. King Kazu, he's obviously going to ride the pine for the remainder of the season because, that's been the true secret to Yokohama FC, giving themselves a fighting chance at the end of the season. All right, so we'll wrap things up ever so quickly with a look ahead to the Matchday 28 fixture list of the drop zone teams. Tokushima opened the match day on Friday night by travelling to Nagoya. The relegation six-pointer over the weekend is Oita hosting Shonan, and that's on Saturday. And then on Sunday, Sendai head to Gamba Osaka, whether you think they're safe or not, Vigalta will certainly fancy their chances with the Gamba rocking after their Levain Cup pasting at the hands of Cerezo. Interestingly enough, it's a Cerezo-Sapporo rematch over the weekend after Cerezo's 3-0 win tonight. Sapporo will be out for revenge. And at the top, F. Marinos can close the gap back to a point when they travel to Hiroshima, with Kawasaki's game at home against Kobe pushed back to the end of the month to allow them time to prepare for next Tuesday's ACL round of 16 clash away to Ulsan of South Korea that we have mentioned. So nine games on the Matchday 28 fixture list over the weekend. Sam, what's your pick of the weekend?
I don't know. I've not been in great form recently, but let's go. I'm going to go Yokohama FC and Urawa, given we've just spoken about Yokohama. I think this is an almost must win at the moment for Yokohama to get themselves out of it. I really hope we see those Brazilians up front. And Reds have got to try and do something that malaise them at the top of the table for these ACL places. So, it has a lot riding on it for both teams. I think both teams should... Well, at least Reds will always go for it, and you'd hope that Yokohama have enough on the counter-attack to cause a few issues. So I think, that's my game of the weekend, and I apologise to anyone watching that now for the 0-0 that's going to follow.
All right, then. And, Scott, I need a one-word answer here. We were hoping to get out of this episode in under an hour, and we're nudging an hour and a half, so, mission accomplished. I need a one-word answer. The three ACL clubs from the J1 are taking on South Korean opponents. How many will make it through to the quarterfinals?
Two.
All right. Should I press you any further, or, you have strong opinions on which two?
Well, not particularly. I'm just, more broadly curious about the draw, where you've got the two best teams in the entire tournament somehow stacked up against each other. Well, it's really unfortunate for Kawasaki. And, I hope they can get through. I really do. I fear for them. But because they've been the benchmark in Japanese football for the past year and a bit. I think heading into this year, it was really all set up for them to do very well in Asia as well, and this kind of losing all these players, injury crisis, and all this, and then I think unjustifiably having to go to away to a very strong team in Korea is all conspiring against them. But I hope they can do well, and I hope they can do well for Toru Oniki as well, because he's been the one constant that's really held the team together, and seeing Ange go across to Europe, I'd love to see a chance for him, to go and do it as well. Japan's best domestic coach who's currently coaching.
All right, and Sam, it would be rude if I didn't ask you the same question. How many J1 clubs do you think will make it through to the ACL quarterfinals?
Mine would also be two. I do fear for Kawasaki. I think they've got a complete rough end of the draw there against Ulsan. But I think Nagoya are a better team than Daegu, and I think Cerezo are coming into a little bit of form, and the home tie against Pohang, I think those two will get through. But yeah, I really do hope that Kawasaki can make it through.
All right, tremendous stuff then. So we will leave it there. And Scott, well, yeah, we hope you rediscover your sense of smell in the coming weeks. Again, whether that would be a good thing or not, living in central Tokyo is up for debate. But yeah, glad to hear you've made it out the other end of COVID-19. And well, yeah, we look forward to catching up with you again as the run-in really heats up.
Cheers. Thanks, guys.
All right. That's great to hear from Scott again. And, well, yes, Sam, another terrific episode. Of course, the listeners have had to wait a little bit longer this week to hear from us, but that means that next week we'll be back with them in a much shorter interval. So, J1 returning this weekend with a really interesting-looking set of fixtures. And, we'll wrap it all up next week.
Yeah, can't wait to get to it. The run-in begins next week, so yeah, should be a lot more interesting at least than the Japan game. So yeah, looking forward to speaking to you next week.
Yes, indeed. No questions asked. All right, well, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Scott McIntyre for his time this week. We'd like to thank our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon, in particular Rascal and Nathan for coming on board in the past couple of weeks. If you'd like to get involved, please head to patreon.com/JTalkPod. And we'll be back next week to round up all of the J1 Match Day 28 action. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast.
Yosh! Ah!